All right, and joining us now, I want to get him in before Christmas, is Eric Peters of epautos.com. And we have so much car talk to talk about. It truly is amazing. But I want to begin with something else that you got at your site, Eric. And that is your story about this abusive relationship we're stuck in with the federal government. Tell us about that.
The one that we've been in since 1865.
Yeah, that's right. That abusive relationship. If you leave, I'll kill you, as you point out. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. I use that graphic. It shows Abraham Lincoln and it has that caption. If you try to leave me, I'll kill you. And I thought that that was very succinct and very apt because it distilled the whole conflict into that witty little meme.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it was all about. You know, on the one hand, we have this cognitive dissonance in this country. On the one hand, kids are taught to revere the founding fathers who seceded from Great Britain.
That's right. You said, if you leave us, we'll kill you. They said, if you leave us, we'll kill you as well.
But somehow when the southern states wanted to exercise the same prerogative, they felt that they were no longer served by being part of this union, just as the colonists thought they were no longer being served by being part of the British Union, and they wanted to separate themselves, leave, in other words, from what they considered to be an abusive relationship. Lincoln did exactly that. He killed, what's the estimate, something around the order of 500,000 Americans were killed.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting. Do you believe these numbers? Exactly the same number of people, north and south, 300,000 each. You know? Of course, that doesn't include civilian deaths, but I think that's a cooked number anyway.
Yeah, and the point is, you know, Lincoln, as Malcolm X, I think, said, Lincoln didn't free the slaves, he enslaved us all.
That's right. That's right. I've said, the way I put it, I said he ended private slavery. And he made us all slaves of the public slaves of the federal government. That's really what happened with all of it. And, you know, the other thing that's interesting, you know, they always want to put this in the context of slavery to put it in the best possible light. But, you know, the northern soldiers didn't call the southern soldiers didn't say slavers, you know, or didn't call them rage accusations of them being racist or having a white privilege or anything. They called them secesh.
Yeah,
they called them rebels. And so it was really about the secession. And, you know, Eric, I've mentioned this on my show. I probably never told you about it. But my brother-in-law went to Italy. My wife's family is half Italian. And he went to Italy to study. And he learned Italian and met some relatives over there. And they gave him a diary that had been put together by an ancestor who fought with Garibaldi's army there. And that was a real eye-opener for me because I realized that Italy was going through a civil war in 1861 exactly as we were. And it wasn't over slavery. It was over the same thing that our war was ultimately about, and that was a fourth turning, going from an agrarian society to an industrial society. And as part of that fourth turning, you had nation states that were being created everywhere. And so you had internal civil wars that were happening everywhere in Italy and Brazil and other places. As a matter of fact, Garibaldi had fought in Brazil. I think it was Brazil or Argentina. I always get those two confused. Anyway, he had fought over there and then went to Italy to fight. So you had this type of this thing, this consolidation because of industrialization. You had this consolidation of the nation state. You had different power centers now because of industrialization versus agrarian. And that's what that war was really about. Everywhere that it was happening. But of course, they spend this for their own particular purposes. And I remember that Stonewall Jackson. Stonewall Jackson said, this is our second war of independence. That's the way he saw it. And that's exactly what it was. You know, people have a right to self-governance. And we see this all the time. You know, we had Ukraine said, well, we're going to secede from Russia. And then the people in Crimea say, well, we want to stay with Russia. No, you can't. We're going to fight you and kill you, you know, and if you do that type of thing.
Any relationship that isn't consensual is ipso facto abusive, isn't it?
That's right.
I mean, if you're compelled, if you're forced by threats of violence to remain in a relationship, I think by definition, it's an abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. The left has been very successful in this etymological ledger domain. You know, using words to change the way people think about things. You know, even you and I were just talking about this, and we use the term the Civil War, and that's an accurate term because it was not a civil war.
That's right.
It was an attempt by the southern states to secede, which is a very different thing.
That's right.
The southern states were not attempting to occupy and control the North and to control the government of the whole. They simply wanted to have their own government and their own country.
That's
and
right.
I think it's important to make that point.
That's right. Yeah, that is exactly what it's two groups of people fighting to control the same country. That's very different than saying we want independence and secession. But you know, as this is all ramping up, and it is getting it is escalating, and we see this. I've said many times, I think that they're setting up Donald Trump, and have set him up for quite some time, to be the Mason-Dixon line of our next civil war.
Yeah, it's horrific. I this morning I was struggling to even find the words after I read news about the decision in Colorado that apparently is going to take Trump off the ballot in that state on the basis of his having been an insurrectionist, notwithstanding that he's not actually been formally charged or convicted. And I'm not carrying water for the orange man by any means. Right. I'm just pointing out this horrible winnowing that we're being kind of pushed down a cattle chute. What they're trying to do, they accuse Trump on the one hand of an insurrection, and they're actually fomenting a real one.
Yes.
Because they're making people so angry and desperate. You know, the same affronterous people who will constantly talk about our democracy and who then tell you who you're allowed to vote for.
That's right.
Now, again, I'm not carrying water for Trump, but if he's a popular candidate and people want to vote for him, okay. And by taking him off the ballot, if they're successful in doing that, they're going to enrage people. And it seems to me inevitable that there's going to be some kind of an incendiary response to this. And I think that that's what they want, frankly.
And they continue to do this. I just talked earlier in the program about how they've now arrested a Blaze photojournalist who was there years after this. They continue to expand this, and I think that that's a real insurrection against our Constitution and our form of government, that the Biden administration continues to cast this net wider and wider. There they came after Sam Montoya at InfoWars and other reporters. Now they're coming after this guy, a bona fide photojournalist, to attack and attack him over just being there. He didn't harm anything. He didn't interfere with anything. He's taking pictures as protected under the Constitution. And so they really do want to ramp this whole thing up. And we got to be careful not to fall into that trap. That's one of the things, Eric, that I'm so concerned about, because you look at it, both the people who oppose Trump and the people who support Trump. What do you think is going to happen? Because one of those groups is not going to get their way.
Yeah.
And so whether he wins or whether he loses, you're going to have half of this country want to kill the other half of the country over Trump. That's really what we're looking at coming up in this next year.
And they're egging it on. You know, the situation is very much analogous to what the situation was back in 1861, when you had this regional difference, broadly brushed between North and South. And you had two mindsets, two cultures, two societies that were at odds with one another.
Yeah.
And this was inflamed and pushed, and it got to a certain point where the kinetic energy became unstoppable and events took their own course.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be exactly what's happening right now with regard to what's going to happen over the course of the next 12 months. And it's pretty scary.
And I just saw this thing from Tucker Carlson. He and Dan Bongino are getting each other worked up. And Tucker Carlson, these guys are your blood enemies. No, they're not. The appropriate response is to debate this. Not to kill these people, but they're escalating this. They really want, both sides want violence, and they keep talking about blood, Trump talking about migrants being blood poisoning or a poison in your blood, And it's like, no, the person who put poison in our blood was you, pal. I mean, it's
astounding.
Yeah.
I have a number of friends, including friends that I have been friends with since I was a teenager, who adamantly will not deal with the business of Trump pushing those drugs on people.
Yes.
And his action during the final year of his presidency. It's as if that just doesn't matter. It's as if, in Orwell's 1984, Crime Stop, when that thought comes up, they just blank and shut down. I say, well, what about the bump stock business? What about the red flag laws?
Yeah.
And it's just like, boom, conversation over.
Yeah.
You're not seeing the big picture of the 5D chess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know. I work for a guy that was always pushing that stuff. But yeah, that is the key thing, isn't it? This blind spot. And now they just shut it down. And I see that through all the press. I see it with Breitbart. I see it with WorldNet Daily. All of these different, I call them the MAGA bird press. You had the Mockingbird press for the CIA. These are the people, the other side of the Hegelian project here, that are just pushing everything for Trump. They absolutely hate the vaccine. People like Wayne Allenroot, but Trump is your savior. Won't say anything negative about him. And we can see how that is happening to politicians who do oppose him. But, let's talk about what's going on with the climate stuff here. Jail time for operators of gas-powered leaf blowers hedgers and mowers. And this is, I mean, literally jail time. This is being pushed in Washington State. Where else? Al Gore said in 2015 that the deniers need to be punished, you know, for violating his religion. And so they want criminal sanctions. And we've got a law that's going into effect this next year in California. They passed it in 2021, but it's going to go into effect this coming year to ban all leaf blowers and lawnmowers and weed trimmers. And so if you don't do that, what are they going to do to you? Well, the one in Washington State is going to go into effect in 2026. So we'll see this one in California is going to happen first. But this is how desperate these people are. Any gasoline, diesel-powered landscaping, other outdoor power equipment is going to be contributing to climate change, and we're going to have to lock you up.
But, you know, this is an inevitability, isn't it? You know, if you accept or if you let go unchallenged the premise that there is a climate crisis, i.e. an existential threat, you know, a dire emergency and we're all going to die, well, then it follows, doesn't it, that you can't permit people to operate anything that produces carbon dioxide. It's even going to get to the point, and I saw a news article about this earlier, where they're starting to worry about people breathing.
Yes,
you're exhaling carbon dioxide, and you're contributing, therefore, to this climate crisis. So you've got to get at the root of this. You've got to talk about the climate crisis, which is a fraud.
Yes.
And if you dispel that, then you can deal with this issue. But you cannot play their game by accepting their terms of the debate.
That's right. And when we talk about it, I talk about both the pandemic thing and the, the climate thing. I call them MacGuffins. It's like, you know, Hitchcock. The MacGuffin is just what motivates the characters, but you always got the same goal at the end of the line. And so we can't talk about the pandemic as being real or the virus as being real. We can't say, well, this is a better way to handle the real pandemic. And we can't talk about a better way to handle the real emissions, because you can't accept those false premises. You're not going to win a debate if you let the other people set up a false foundation for that debate and you go along with that. You're going to lose. And so you got to stop talking about emissions, because, again, it comes down to our breath. And because this has been before the environmental movement even started, you know, in 1970, the first Earth Day, they had already based it on the population bomb. So this has always been about stopping us breathing and stopping us doing everything. So it's always been about killing people. And so that's, you have to understand that we just don't accept their premise that there is a virus, a pandemic, or a climate crisis. You cannot play that game with them.
Yeah, I try to, for example, I refer to the event that was marketed as a pandemic. And then I will deconstruct that a little bit. And I'll point out that, yeah, it's technically true. If you really want to be pedantic about it, that it was a pandemic in the sense that maybe there was a bug going around. But the key to understanding this, I think, is the disingenuousness of it. Because to the average person, when they hear that word pandemic, it calls up immediately associations of mass death. And that's exactly what they wanted by using that term. It's a dishonest way of having a discussion about it. Just the same when they talk about emissions, you know, which the implication there is that it's a pollutant. The implication then is that you're causing some sort of harm to the external environment. And to characterize carbon dioxide, which plants need in order to create oxygen so that we can breathe, as a pollutant is preposterous.
That's right.
So it's really important to deconstruct all of these things. And it's a lot of work. It's literally like cleaning out the Augean stables. You know, you have to parse almost every word that's used today in the debate. I wish I could remember the exact phraseology of it, but I think it was R. Emmett Terrell back in the 90s, and he talked about something he called the culture smog. Do you remember that term?
Yeah.
And what he meant by that was that everything is so fraught now with this dishonest language that causes people to think of things in a certain way that it becomes almost impossible to have a rational discussion about anything without first going back and picking apart these words and trying to figure out, well, what exactly is meant by that word? What is the point of view that they're trying to convey? And let's discuss that before we have the broader discussion.
That's right. And you know, you mentioned the term smog, right? When's the last time we've heard the term smog? Nobody talks about that anymore because we got rid of it. Right? They put on emission controls and everything. And we don't have smog. But smog was just, something that they used to take us to the next step. Right?
Isn't it astounding, the neurosis of people?
Yeah.
You know, that they can't, okay, all right, they're telling me that there's something that's dangerous out there. I'm going to use my eyes and look. I'm looking out the window of my office. The sky's blue. It seems pretty nice out there. Just like with the virus. Oh, there's this invisible boogeyman. It's going to kill us all. It's invisible. It's always invisible, isn't it? They're literally turning the populace into a bunch of neurotic, hysterically scared children who are crawling under the bed to hide because there's danger everywhere.
Yeah,
I said everybody on pins and needles.
I said back in April 2020, I said we've become an OCD nation. I mean, everybody was wiping everything down, masks and gloves, and I can't get gas. I'm afraid I'm going to catch the virus. These people are crazy. Now, the pandemic was political, and it was psychological. It wasn't biological. Right. And that's what we have to understand. Yes, there were additional people who died, and they were dying from stuff like the ventilators and the medical protocols and the remdesivir and things like that. That was actually killing more people, and they were being paid handsomely to kill people by the Trump administration.
How about stress and loneliness? You know, shutting old people in homes where they had no access to their family.
Yes.
And giving them no hope and no reason to live, you know, that'll sap the life out of an elderly person. And that's what happened to a lot of them.
That's right. Well, you know, getting back to this thing, they face up to a year in jail in Washington State for having a leaf blower.
It's going to get worse.
Insanity. Oh, yeah. And then, of course, you know, Biden is coming after ceiling fans. After he shuts down our air conditioning, he wants to come after the ceiling fans, and he wants to redesign them, quote unquote, for efficiency to the extent that nobody will be able to afford them. That is really what we're looking at here. This is New York, and this is up in the Buffalo area where they do get a lot of snow. They have the lake effect that's up there. And now what they're doing, though, this harkens back to the kinds of controls that we had during Trump's lockdown. They want to enforce travel bans for weather and for any other catastrophes that they could imagine, right? So it's all there. We didn't get rid of any of this stuff. They're going to bring it back. They're going to have different MacGuffins, but they're still going to get their travel bans, which is what they really want. And in this particular case, I guess you could say it's a travel ban over the climate because it's a travel ban over the weather. But that's really what they want to have is that, and they will give travel exemptions to essential people. Oh, isn't this it's the same language that Trump used?
Yeah. You know, the safety cult, I wrote about this probably 10 or 15 years ago. I predicted that it's going to metastasize to the point where if there's a snowflake wafting down from the sky, or if we're going to get some heavy rain, they're going to impose travel bans because it's not safe to be on the roads. You know, they've already asserted and established the precedent for all of these things. And since they haven't been challenged, they're going to continue to use them. You know, everything that occurred during the past 3 years, none of that has yet been fully rejected as unwarranted, unreasonable, tyrannical. They simply dialed it back a little bit, and they're waiting for their next opportunity to bring it back out of the toolkit.
Yeah. I remember when this happened in 2020, and they went around, they gave us a paper and said, you know, try to make a case that, you know, this person is engaged in a central thing of informing the public or whatever, and, you know, these are not the droids you're looking for, officer, let him go, you know? I never had to use that at a stop. I never had to do any of those Jedi mind tricks. But that is exactly what they're saying with this. We're going to have a list of essential employees that'll be reviewed annually, and essential employers, and they'll be asked to provide updates, and then you'll have to show your identity papers to the stormtroopers.
Yeah.
I think that they're literal stormtroopers. They send them out when there's a storm.
Yeah, and then just wait. You know, if by some happenstance the Orange Man is brought back into office next year, then to solve this problem of the illegal aliens who've been entering the country, Americans are just going to have to deal with showing their papers at checkpoints because we just can't have all of these illegal aliens running around through the country.
Oh, yeah.
They have to figure out who's here. That's what they're going to do. In that case.
Oh, absolutely right. I mean, it's already started with DeSantis in Florida and the Republicans in Florida. They said, we're going to have E-Verify and we're going to make it mandatory. And see, E-Verify has been around for a while and Republicans have always referred back to that. And I've said, no, that is a trap. Do not do that. You know, we're going to leave the borders wide open, but now you Americans are going to have to get an ID. And they're already talking about this because you got people like Michelle Wu saying, we're going to let foreigners vote in our elections. So now the Republicans would say, no, we got to have something to prove that you're an American citizen. You're going to have E-Verify to vote. You're going to have to, don't give me a reason to not vote. I've got many enough of them as it is right now. But, you know, you're going to have to show your E-Verify to vote. Your E-Verify, as you point out, maybe to drive to the store. It's just crazy, but it's always a problem. And then they've already got the solution set up, and the solution always comes for all these problems that they've created. It always goes back to a digital ID. So you're just going to have that on your phone.
Yeah, and fundamentally, doesn't this all earlier with regard to consent. None of us have consented to this that I'm aware of.
That's right.
It's just being imposed upon us. And I think the only way we're going to get out of this is to reassert that unless I have freely consented to something, then it is illegitimate. And you do not have the right to oppress me with a contract that I've been coerced into being a party to.
That's right. Yeah, well, I think it's going to create the necessitation for a secession of sorts. And I've talked to people from the 10th Amendment Center and others, and they pointed out, they said, you know, the middle ground here is nullification and non-commandeering. And those have already been upheld. And they're in, you know, it's clear that you can have local officials who say, well, we're just not going to enforce those laws. And we saw that happening in 2020. That really is probably our best approach for all this, is just to say, we're going to focus on trying to get people in office locally who are not going to do this, even if the state government is doing it. At the very beginning of this, I remember there was a guy who had a church that he kept open. So they put him on Fox News. He got a lot of attention. He was in Illinois, and Pritzker wanted to shut down the church there. Well, he got the sheriff there in that area, the sheriff and his deputies, because Pritzker was saying, well, we're going to send the state police down there and we're going to arrest you people if you go to church. He got the sheriff and his deputies, and the sheriff went to his church, small town. And so, you know, Sheriff Taylor and Barney Fife go out, and then Barney puts his bullet in, and they guard the people there, the church, from being arrested. And they, fortunately, it didn't, you know, come to a confrontation or anything. But, you know, they were there to stop that from happening, to stop them from being harassed. And so, you know, you can, if you got the right people, you can do things to stop that kind of intrusion.
Yep, noncompliance is a very powerful tool, even when it's only practiced by an individual. But when more individuals decide to practice it, then it takes on a kind of kinetic energy all of its own. Mm-hmm. A point comes when something becomes unenforceable because it becomes ridiculous. You know, go back a few years. A really good example of that is the old 55-mile-an-hour national speed limit. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
It became preposterous. You know, they kept it in force for 20 years, but everybody mocked it. Everybody dissipated it. Totally delegitimized traffic enforcement because everybody knew it was just a scam to get money. Mm-hmm. And they eventually had to repeal it. And that's a really good object lesson in how to deal with this stuff. Mm-hmm. You and I have talked before, you know, during the event that was marketed as a pandemic. If only enough people had refused to obey the mask mandates.
That's right.
If only that had happened, it would have become unenforceable within a month. And the whole thing would have fallen apart, if only. So that's a lesson to take from that episode when the next episode comes up.
And I tried to point out to people, you know, throughout the lockdown stuff, I said, look at what happened with medical marijuana and with pot prohibition, right? What do we have? We got more than half of the states have said, even though it is now still listed as a class one drug in their war on drugs, more than half of the states have said, well, we're not going to enforce that. And we're not going to arrest people for that, even for recreational use in some states. So whether or not you agree with pot prohibition, like all the drug war, is against the Constitution. They never passed an amendment like the 18th Amendment to prohibit any of this stuff, and they never had the power. And so you have somebody like Jeff Sessions who was, you know, had fully succumbed to reefer madness. And he wanted to shut this down so badly, but he never would. And that's why I say, you know, he didn't want to show how they had bullied and bluffed people over this issue where they had absolutely no legal authority. And that is a real shining example. Regardless of what side you're on about marijuana or pot, that's a shining example of how you can shut down one of the biggest government agendas, the drug war. Because it was marijuana and pot that they were locking the most people up for during the war on drugs. And to shut that down, you know, the states have used it as a way to make money, and they've got their own regulations and things like that. But the bottom line is what it teaches us about authority when they overreach their authority.
I think many of us have forgotten the lesson that most of us did learn in elementary school, which is that you're not going to get anywhere by deferring to bullies. You'll never comply your way out of bullying.
That's right.
You know, it's not pleasant, but you have to stand up to bullies. And if you stand up to them, then the bullying stops. And if only enough people would just practice that standing up, even if it just means, no, I'm not going to do that.
That's right.
You know, come with me. Okay, I'm whatever. If we would just recover our spine as a society, then most of these problems would no longer be problems, at least not to the extent that they are.
If you got a critical mass of people, a local area, and they elect people in town government and a sheriff and things like that, you have to have a critical mass to have that happen. And that critical mass can stand around those elected officials who are going to stand in the gap and stop this from happening. Yeah. Yep. Let's talk about one of your articles here. Another entry luxury priced entry level vehicle. I like that. A luxury priced entry level vehicle. Which one is this?
Well, let's start with some terminology. In the car business, the term entry luxury referred to a luxury brand's least expensive model, but it was still expensive. And the bar typically defining that was about $34,000-$35,000. That's what you used to pay for, say, an entry luxury Lexus or a BMW or a Mercedes and what have you. And the counter to that was the entry level car, which was typically synonymous with an economy car, an affordable car. A good example of an entry level car would be something like a Toyota Corolla, let's say. Mm-hmm. Well, as we transition into the world of battery powered vehicles, the entry level car is becoming the entry luxury priced car. All of the latest EVs that they're bringing out, and they're marketing these things as affordable, have prices that start right around what used to be the defining price point for an entry luxury car. Fiat is bringing back their little 500 micro car as an electric car. It's going to start around $34,000. Volkswagen has just announced that they're going to bring out their entry level electric crossover. It's going to start around $34,000-$35,000.
Wow.
That's what they're pushing now. And there's this interesting malevolence behind it, in that it's being pushed by the left, and the left putatively cares about the working man, the average guy, right? If you're still buying that. Anyway, it's very clear that a working man, an average blue collar guy, is not going to be able to afford to spend $34,000 or $35,000 on a car. Yeah. So it's very clear the intent is to just pull all of these people who cannot afford that price of entry out of cars.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, especially with interest rates where they are at this point in time. You know, it's interesting to see this in the UK. They went through some of their models, and it's not really important what the models are, but across the board, they had 30 used models of EV that had plunged the most value in 2023. And so they had 30 different models of EVs that had lost half of their value in the first year. That's tremendous drop, and that is indicative of the collapsing demand for EVs in general and the price premium that they have to charge for these things. It's just
it's also indicative of something else. You know, yeah. It's not just that they depreciate as all cars do. It's the used electric car has a used battery, and batteries as they age lose their capacity to hold a charge. And so now you're going to get a vehicle that had started out with, let's say, the ability to maybe go 200 and something miles on a charge. Now it only goes 150. Mm-hmm. And if you hold on to it a little bit more, it's only going to go 75, and then it's not going to go at all. And if you want to go any farther, you're going to have to replace that battery. Now you're looking at spending $10,000, $15,000, even $20,000 on a battery for an electric car that you bought for $10,000 or $15,000. Nobody's going to do that. And that's why they're not selling.
Yeah. And we all know that. We know that from experience. We know what happens to our phones and our laptops. I mean, all of our laptops are so old that, they're not. They don't function unless they're plugged into the wall now is what the situation is around here. You know, I can run my laptop for maybe about 20 minutes and then I better get it plugged into the wall or it's gone. And so that's what happens. You know, they charge up more slowly. They discharge more rapidly. They aren't able to last with that thing. And we've all experienced that with all of our electronic devices. Why do people think the cars are going to be any different? It's just a bigger problem and a more expensive battery to replace.
Well, it's far worse because with, say, a laptop, a laptop doesn't have to move. It just sits on your desk. So the battery in the laptop is relatively small. And typically, proportionately to the value of the laptop, it might be worth spending $150 or whatever on a new battery for a laptop rather than buying a new laptop for $800, let's say. Mm-hmm. But the cost of battery replacement is so exorbitantly high that it's unmanageable. That's right. Doesn't matter how much you want. You know, the bottom line is, okay, I'm going to put $15,000 on my credit card at 30% interest to pay for a new battery for this used EV. It's insane. Economically speaking, nobody's going to do that.
And the battery is more expensive than the value of the car as it's depreciating. And now, so you've got this accelerating trend, people, because the battery the prices of them are going down, but now because the prices of them are going down, it doesn't make any sense. It makes even less sense to replace the battery. You know, and the hypocrisy of all this is kind of interesting, Eric, because this thing that I use here, my pad that I put my articles on to try to go paperless, I got an update from them, and they've got a new model for this year, and it's got a removable battery. Why? Because the EU has mandated that they have to have removable batteries for these things. And yet they keep mandating the EVs for people that don't have removable batteries that are easily replaced or at least affordably replaced either. You know what I'm saying? It is kind of crazy that, you know, they're for a small device like this, it's not all that expensive. They're going to mandate that it's going to have a replaceable battery that is easily replaced and everything. And yet for the cars, they're not easily replaced and certainly not economically replaced, regardless of how easy it is to get them out of there.
It's only crazy if you start with the assumption that this is some kind of well-intended effort to simply replace the cars that we're driving right now with these electric cars because they're better for the environment. And that's just, it's not the right way to look at it.
That's right.
This is malicious. They understand perfectly well what this is all about. And the point of it is to use the electric vehicle as the vehicle to get most people out of cars. They're well aware of the cost issues. They're well aware of the practicality issues. They know that there isn't sufficient electrical capacity to power up an entire national fleet of EVs, if such a thing existed. They know this, the whole point. And it's not me hypothesizing here. You can read their documents. In one of my most recent articles, I've linked to one of the documents where they very specifically say what they want is to get roughly two-thirds of the cars off the road, two-thirds of the people out of cars. And this is the mechanism by which they're going to accomplish that.
That's right. Yeah, and that's just the next step. You know, the ultimate goal is to get everybody out of their cars. And you know, you're right, it's not irony. It's just hypocrisy, and it's a real malevolent hypocrisy that they've got going there. But we've also seen now, you know, last time you were on, we talked about how some of the American car companies are pulling back. Now Audi is pulling back on electric vehicles. You've got the CEO there saying that he wants to avoid flooding dealerships. So we've also talked about that, how the inventory is backing up for all types of cars because of high interest rates, but especially for the EVs. And he said that they forecasted that electric car take-up is going to be slashed by about half from last month. Sales of new battery-powered cars expected to grow steadily until they accounted for 67% of the market by 2027, but that has now been revised down from 67% to an expectation of 38%, and I think that that is optimistic because I think now word is getting out as the people who are the early adopters have tried to do this, and of course, they're now also facing cheaper cars and competition from China. Audi has been kind of a luxury model, and you got a review about one of the Audis. As a matter of fact, you got a review about one of the luxury Audis. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the A8, it's kind of a depressing review in that the A8 is Audi's top-of-the-line model. It's in the same class of cars, a Mercedes S-Class or a BMW 7 Series. And if you go back, just a few years, go back about 10 years, a car like the Audi A8 would have come minimally with a V8 engine as a standard engine. Mm-hmm. And typically cars in that class, and we're talking about six-figure cars here, you know, cars that have a starting price around $80,000, $90,000, $100,000, would have the option to go with a V12 engine. In the case of the A8, they had a W12. You remember that?
Wow. No, I don't remember that.
Exotic. Because after all, you're spending essentially exotic money. You're spending nearly $100,000 for one of these things. Yeah. You know, you're not buying a Corolla or a Camry. Mm-hmm. Well, now this top-of-the-line Audi, and similarly, the top-of-the-line Mercedes and the top-of-the-line BMW, they come standard with a little V6 engine because the V6 is now becoming the new V12. You know, it's something that's exclusive and exotic. As on the lower end of the spectrum, I wrote about this recently, Toyota is pulling the V6 out of the Camry. They canceled the Avalon altogether, which was a slightly larger version of the Camry. And they're both now going to be four-cylinder only hybrids. So, you know, the proletariat, the peons can have a four-cylinder engine, which used to be kind of synonymous with an economy car. And that's exactly what it is, except the price isn't economy anymore. Whereas if you have the means, you know, if you're in that category of person who can afford something like an A8, now you can have a V6, but that's all you can have for, you know, for $90,000.
And the people who didn't buy one a couple of years ago are smacking themselves in the head saying, I could have had a V8, but you can't get it anymore. And of course, as they do that, Eric, it plays to the major selling point of the EVs, which is just straight line acceleration.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Very interesting.
And I had some inside baseball conversations with a person. I can't really talk about it directly yet. I'm going to be writing about this at one of the major luxury car brands, who was kind of chastising me about my position in the electric vehicles. And I said to this person, what will be the selling point of your brand when all you sell are battery-powered devices and everybody else is selling battery-powered devices? And there really isn't any material difference between your device and their device. It's going to be EverReady or Energizer over here. I mean, how are you going to, where does, you know, at one point you had these wonderful particular types of engines that the other manufacturers didn't have, and that was a selling point. Well, that's all going away when everything has a battery and a motor. You can make a bigger battery, a smaller battery, but there's no personality. There's nothing particular about it. So why not just have one conglomerated motors company that sells different shapes of extruded plastic blobs, you know, with different size motors or different power configurations, and it's just all the same homogenized stuff coming out of this, being squeezed out of the same factory somewhere.
Well, that's when you call in the descendants of Edward Bernays and and Madison Avenue, and you create this mystique around a brand, and you charge, you know, three times as much for it. And then, you know, it just becomes a status symbol. It's not that there's any functionally a different thing about them at all. You know, it's kind of interesting. I'm sure you saw this about the cyber truck that got stuck. Many people call it the cyber stuck. And as I showed this thing being pulled out by a Ford pickup truck, and I think that it was the CEO of Ford that said, well, this is an early Christmas gift or something to that extent, to show that the cyber truck was being pulled out by a gasoline engine Ford truck. But it is kind of interesting to see how this is developing. And now we've got Elon Musk, who has made a pivot to saying, well, we're not going to be able to get rid of fossil fuels in the short term, or maybe even in the medium term. So we need to kind of get used to it. And boy, he is just being eviscerated by the climate cult over that statement.
You know, I'm not sure what to make of Musk. I'd actually like to meet that guy and have a conversation with him. You know, I see parallels with Trump, and that he'll say things that for an audience that is desperate to hear something that sounds like it might possibly indicate that that person is in favor of liberty to some degree or other, that they just lap it right up, and then they shut down their minds to anything that is dissonant, you know, that makes that questionable. You know, Musk has talked greatly about how he's going to be a big proponent of free speech and how X is now not what Twitter was. And it's simply not the case. I can tell you that I've been shadow banned repeatedly. I'm sure you've dealt with this thing. And recently, I even documented it in an article that I wrote about it. Yeah. If people are interested in that, it's up on the site. And Elon Musk, oh my God, his entire operation, he's been the stalking horse. He's been the tip of the spear for this whole forced electrification thing. He used the government to leverage his business to extort money through the carbon tax, a carbon credit regime, to extort all of the legitimate automakers to finance his business, to foist these EVs out there, and to create kind of a fait accompli situation where all the other manufacturers now have to create the same kinds of electrified devices, and that's all we're going to be allowed. And now he's telling us, well, maybe we have to stick around with some fossil fuels for a while. I don't understand it.
Yeah. I the very first time we talked, I mentioned this because I talked about Elon Musk the other day about this. I said, you know, look, the guy's a technocrat. He's a transhumanist. He's not on your side, and he's going to do the same thing to you. These people on the left are so angry with him now because they feel like he's betrayed them. But I guess when he does it to the right, they will still be just as incapable of saying that they've been betrayed as they are with Trump. But I said, you know, he sold all this stuff to become the richest man in the world. And as all these conservatives are writing article after article about, oh, Elon Musk, look at this, the richest man in the world is going to use his fortune to buy our free speech back from these people who want to make slaves out of us. It's like, is that really what he's going to do? And I showed a clip of when Thierry Breton, the censor in the EU, the guy who's head of the censorship in EU, came to Austin after he bought Twitter and lectured Elon Musk about how the DSA was going to be coming into effect. I call Thierry Breton, I call him the conspiracy theory, because he's part of this conspiracy to shut down free speech. And so he comes there and Elon Musk is just groveling before him. And so you get this conflicting stuff, but I think he's just playing to the audience. And I think he's playing them in the same way that Trump did. I think he's smart enough to really understand. I think he could sit there and watch how Trump played the MAGA crowd and say, you know, I can do that too. because yeah, he's already talked about how he says Soros has picked these races for district attorneys and other things like that. He's realized that he gets more bang for his buck if he goes to the local elections. Musk is very, very political. You know, he became the richest man in the world by playing politics with all of these dictators worldwide, including our American dictators. And he knows exactly how the political game is being played. He is very understanding of the strategy there about Soros. And he's got his own strategy. And I think that he is playing the Trump game with all this stuff.
Yeah, it's like a game of whack-a-mole. And yeah, it's a very successful maneuver in that it diverts people from really understanding the nature of their enemy by thinking that he's their friend. And it's the same strategy used by the Trumper people too. And it's to me, it's very tragic because most people who are being manipulated in this manner are well-meant people. You know, they're trying to grab onto something. They know that something's very profoundly wrong with the country. And they are desperate. What can we do? What can we do? You know, back in history, if you read about the late czarist, early pre-communist era when Russians were exasperated, what is to be done was the name of a famous essay back then, because it seemed as if their world was crumbling around them. And normal people want order, not chaos. They want calm, not violence everywhere. And so they're so enervated and they're so upset that they will just latch onto if they think that might be the one, that might be our solution. Instead of thinking, you know, we need to look into ourselves and we need to take care of ourselves somehow and recover our power that way and stop being led. I don't want a Führer. You know, the German word means leader. I'm not looking for a leader. I'm an adult. I can direct my own life. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And I think that if people in this country recover that, which used to be a typical American mindset, we used to be a nation of skeptical people who practiced due diligence. We wanted to, if there was somebody presented us with something, we had questions and we demand answers. And if the answers weren't good, we wouldn't put up with it. And we need to get back to that somehow.
Yeah, I've said many times when I was young, people used to say, well, you know, don't make a federal case out of this. Well, everything is a federal case now, right?
Yep. Yes, absolutely.
Somebody's like, there ought to be a law. And it's like, no, there ought not to be a law about that. And certainly don't want to make it a federal law. But, you know, which you mentioned how Musk has been a stalking horse for all this stuff. And he has. And this is one of the reasons why he's hated so much on the left, because they feel betrayed by him. This publication of Futurism, talking about Musk and how he says, well, we're going to still need fossil fuels in the short and medium term. They said Musk is willing to renege on his commitments to the environment to score political points, even if that means undercutting the very mission of his EV maker, Tesla, which warns that a delay in moving to renewables could, quote, increase the risk of global climate change with potentially disastrous consequences worldwide. So Tesla is still selling this. Tesla knows how the game is being played. Tesla is still a stalking horse. And Musk is still tied into all this stuff at the very beginning. And here's an example. You know, the Cybertruck comes out. And so Jay Leno is talking to the chief designer of the Cybertruck. And they start talking about inductive charging. And this happens at exactly the same time that the state of Florida is talking about setting up a road that is going to inductively charge EVs. Well, there's not any EVs that are inductively charged right now. And so Musk is going to be there right at the very beginning. You know, he's going to present what these places, you know, what these governments want to do in order to push this EV agenda. He's going to be there right from the very beginning. He's still on board with this 2030 agenda and still on the cutting edge. Sorry.
You know, and as you were reading that, I was doing my little etymological dissection that it's become a rote habit for me when I read and hear things. Commitment to the environment. Well, yeah. How do you do that? I mean, it's just a dumb phrase, right?
It is.
It's a non-specific feel-good virtue signaling phrase.
Yeah.
And they get away with this stuff. And, you know, you even read it. I wrote an article today about something that was in Scientific American, and I can't remember. I've got so many balls up in the air what it was all about. But Scientific American used to be a reputable publication. You know, science used to be about specifics, because that's what the nature of science is. You have to understand what you're talking about in order to talk about it intelligently. It has to be something that can be examined and that can be evaluated in terms of facts. And if it isn't, for example, climate change, what does that mean exactly? There is no meaning to it exactly because it's amorphous, it's vague. The climate changes, okay, well, oh, so it's a political term. It's a very deliberate political term that's designed to encompass anything at all. And that's the point of it. And in the mind of anybody who has been trained to think critically at all, it ought to raise red flags because of its non-specific nature. Forgive me, I've been drinking way too much coffee this morning.
Yeah, well, you know, I that's exactly right. It was for the first 8 years or so after Earth Day, it was all about a new ice age. And it's going to be global cooling. And then all of a sudden, they just flipped the switch and it became global warming. And then it stayed there until about, I guess, what was it, about 10, 15 years ago, maybe not even that long. And they just changed it to, well, it's just going to be climate change. Well, climate change doesn't mean anything. You know, they just give up on the ice age. They give up on the warming. And so now they've got a term that they can use. And whatever happens, you know, again, if it's too much snow or not enough snow, well, it's because of your internal combustion engine. But it truly is amazing to see how he is always there on the cusp of all this stuff, isn't it?
And well, he's not an idiot. You know, he didn't get to be the world's richest man by being an imbecile. He's definitely smart. The question is whether he's honorable and trustworthy. And I think we know the answer to those questions.
And the sad thing, too, is that, you know, where they're going to build this induction road, you know, talk about if we build it, they will come. You know, we're going to build this induction road where they charge the cars. And yet there's not any cars that have inductive charging on them yet. But I'm sure that they'll build it. And here is Elon Musk to fulfill that for these government agencies. But this is coming from Republican Florida, conservative Republican Florida. The Central Florida Expressway Authority is going to be the ones who are going to do this. So it's a big boondoggle from them. And, you know, we've talked for the longest time about the autopilot, which was the big, high-tech cherry that he put on there, which is not really working, and how he has been able to skate around all these draconian measures that they pull against people like VW for quote-unquote cheating on an emission thing. Now you got Tesla drivers are now being forced to pay after killing two people on autopilot, and that's one of the things that we all talked about, that we talked about over the years, you and I. Who's going to have the liability when the autopilot kills people? Is it going to be the insurance company? Is it going to be Tesla, the automobile company? Or is it going to be the person who owned the car and is sitting in the car while they got it on autopilot? And that's what they decided in this particular one. It's not going to be Musk. It's going to be you. Right. That's going to be holding the bag.
Right. That's because they've got the little lawyer screen in the car.
That's right.
And the language in the agreement, the user agreement, that says, the driver is responsible for being ready to intervene at any time and maintaining the ability to control the car. But of course, that flies at odds with the plain meaning of autopilot. You know, they chose that term deliberately. It's an aviation term.
Yeah.
You know, so when a commercial plane is up at altitude and it's not necessary to be directly constantly involved in the operation of the plane, you can put it on autopilot. The pilot still has to sit there by law in the left seat and be monitoring. But that's the term implies that the thing is going to fly itself, which is technically true. But in terms of the car, of course it doesn't, you know, and yet you're placed in this paradoxical position as the person who owns the car. Okay, I'm going to spend the money because I want the car to be capable of driving itself. But then if it wrecks because I wasn't paying attention to the driving, it's my fault for using the autopilot. Yeah. And Musk somehow manages to get away with that. And it's despicable.
That's right. So he's got the Trump game down already.
Yes.
He was just playing 4D chess with you when he sold you autopilot. You know,
autopilot either is or it isn't. If it's not able to safely drive the car, then it's not autopilot. That's and there's no point in having it. And you might as well just be the driver of the car, right?
That's right. Well, while we're talking about autopilot, take a look at what is going on in the UK. They are now rolling out. They rolled it out in Wales, and now you got Sadiq Khan, who is rolling it out around the London area. They're changing the speed limits from 30 to 20. Mm-hmm. And spending a lot of money to put signage up, and they're going to be issuing speeding tickets and all the rest of this kind of stuff. But, you know, when you look at this, Eric, it reminds me of what we were just talking about when we said, what is the strong point, really, of the electric vehicles? And that is straight line acceleration. Yep. And so what are you doing now? Well, they're making the cars go down to four-cylinder engines, right?
Yeah.
To highlight that. And so when you look at this, you know, what is their problem with the self-driving taxis, with all the Johnny cabs that they just shut down in California and other things like that? Well, it's the fact that they can't really navigate this stuff, and they're super slow, and you know, they can't make these decisions quickly. And so they've got to go really slow, like you're in some kind of a self-driving golf cart or something. So when they start lowering the speed limit from 30 to 20, what are they doing? Well, first of all, they're frustrating drivers. It's like, why am I even bothering with this thing, right? And then, you know, tickets being issued with you by speed cameras and all the rest of this stuff all the time. And now to take it down to the speed that Johnny Cab can drive. So she says, all right, fine, I'm just done. I can't drive more than 20 miles an hour anyway. So here, have the keys to my car and you can have my car. You know, that's really what they're doing, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it's something, it's what they call law enforcement a clue, you know, to people who like Teslas and these ludicrously fast accelerating electric vehicles generally. They are going to make it so that you can't make use of the one thing that the EV has that most other cars don't have. They're letting you know, knocking on wood here. Be aware, you know, you're going to have your $100,000 Tesla S with the hypothetical capability of going to 0-60 in 2.9 seconds. But if you use it, you know, you're going to...
Yeah, I know. You're right. You're back to these hypercars that, you know, it can go 170 miles an hour. It's like, okay, go ahead and try that. You know, it's like the song.
You can discern here, like the ultimate object of all of this is to make driving so unbearable, so unpleasant, so expensive that people will throw up their hands in despair and say, okay, I give in. I'll just walk, or I'll ride the bicycle, or I'll take the train. Yeah. And that's exactly what they want.
That's right. It reminds me of the old song. Oh, I can't remember the name of it, but the line goes, my Maserati does 195. I lost my license. Now I can't drive.
Yeah.
That's what we're going to be with all this stuff. Yep. Yeah, they want to make life impossible for us, whether it's an automobile or a ceiling fan. They got to take that away from us. It truly is. And they don't care what we think. Here in this situation, they had 500,000 people sign a petition against this hated policy. That's the way it's reported in the UK, of lowering it from 30 to 20. And they just blew it off. They said, we don't care. They said, this is going to save lives. And it's like, okay. And we know they've had their Vision Zero for a long time. Everything is about zero. Everything is, you know, we got net zero, but they had Vision Zero, which was to say, we're going to have no lives lost. And of course, a big part of Vision Zero was to make sure that we're going to turn everything over to autopilot. And you know, we're still seeing that the autopilot is killing people. It is always going to be a situation, but that's the way they justify all the road diets and all the road calming issues and all the lowering of the speed limits and everything. We got to just stop everybody from dying. And yet everything else that they do in this cynical hypocrisy is set up to depopulation, you know, to create depopulation, death by government. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Well, zero is the mark of a fanatic.
Yeah.
It's not reasonable.
That's right.
You know, you're talking about something that is being used as a pretext for almost unimaginable tyranny, because, you know, in a rational, reasonable world, there are costs and there are benefits, there are pros and cons, and it's a spectrum, and you weigh things and you come up with a reasonable middle ground. You know, if you're not a bad person, you're not somebody who's in the grip of some kind of deranged religious mania, which is what we're dealing with here. I use the word religion. It's secular, but it's still a religion. These people have a faith. It's an evil faith, but they're no less fervent on account of that. And it's kind of the Torquemada-esque, there can be no apostasy anywhere. You know, we cannot permit the slightest heresy. You know, if you violate the dogma, if you violate the coda, then you are a heretic and you must be burned at the stake. You know, metaphorically as well as potentially literally with regard to the stuff that we're talking about.
Oh, yeah. I think it's a really good point you made. It really is, you know, it's the mark of a fanatic to talk about zero, and everything they talk about is zero. You know, absolute zero. That, I guess because they're absolutists, you know, they want everything to absolutely go to zero. And when they're talking about saving lives in this petition, they said that, you know, the government is claiming that it's reducing this to 20 miles per hour, and they put all uppercase everywhere because that's where they want to do it, everywhere, saves lives. Yet we get flyers merely claiming that it will. We don't have any evidence about this. We've got opinions from doctors, but there's no evidence. It's just the same MacGuffin that they played on us through this so-called pandemic. At least one of the trials, they said, however, in villages, actually reverted their trial because it was causing absolute carnage on the road. They said that every time I go out, they said nobody is driving at 20 miles an hour. The Welsh government has failed to produce any convincing evidence to support these claims. Again, it's the same tactic they keep using. There was never, they don't show you the data for the climate stuff. They don't show you the data for their imposed regulations. They didn't show you the data for their supposed virus and pandemic, and they don't show you the data for their solution, the jab. They hide
everything.
Let's
take it to its logical conclusion. Let's forbid all movement as a way to achieve Vision Zero. And even then, you're not going to do it because inevitably there's going to be somebody who might have a heart attack while they're lying in bed. Mm-hmm. You know, it reveals the religious mania of these people, and it's a dishonest mania. They know it is. They're just using this to gaslight people. You know, they put forward, well, you know, somebody might die. Oh, it's always a hypothetical. Somebody might be injured as the pretextual excuse and justification to impose something obnoxious and tyrannical on everybody.
Mm-hmm. And you know, these politicians are really no better than these idiots who are gluing themselves to the highway and creating massive roadblocks and causing people with medical emergencies to have serious medical consequences or even die. That's really what is happening. But the politicians are doing that in reality with their regulations. I've got a comment here for you. This is on Rumble. Thank you very much for the tip, YJ72. I'm very curious, said, why don't we hear about updated tests for COVID-19 yet? Because there's so many variants. How do we test for something new with an existing test? That's a very good question. I love that. What do you think about that? That's a good retort.
Well, you know, I'm not really sure about these tests. Isn't it the case that if you put a banana in the blender and cycle it enough, you'll come up with a positive test?
That's right. So, I've had people, as a matter of fact, Andy was saying he's EMS, and he was saying, we had a nurse who tested one of these things right out of the package and got a positive test for it. I think it was all just harassment if you look at it, right? Because, and I've said this, you look at the Cannes Film Festival, and all these elitists show up, and this was just a couple of months before they were going to go the next stage of saying you're going to have a vaccine or you're not going to go anywhere. But they held off on that so they could have their Cannes Film Festival in France. And as these people showed up, they were saying, this is disgusting. I have to spit in this container to get a COVID test. And it's like, you get to spit? We get this thing ramrodded up our nose if you submit to that. And then in China, they were doing it rectally, you know, to the State Department employees.
And well, it's not just disgusting, it's degrading.
Yeah, you know, it is. That's the point.
I maintain that was part of the reason for the pushing of the masks as well, because it's a humiliation ritual.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just making somebody do something, it's making somebody do something that is degrading and embarrassing.
Yes.
And there's a purpose psychologically for that.
And the masks were the same way. You know, how could you believe that these little, and there's no definition of what a mask is. You know, it could be anything. And so it was all just an exercise in humiliation, obedience, and power. It was a psychological experience, that experiment. That's true. But that's a very good observation, YJ. I think that is true. You know, to call their bluff on that and say, well, how is it that you got all these new variants and yet you haven't changed the test? And how do you know how to test for this thing? What are you testing for anyway? Yeah, the whole thing was a scam, wasn't it? And that really kind of shows it right there, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
That's great. And I've got another person who left a tip on Rumble. Thank you, KFB, very much, and wished us happy Merry Christmas. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And it's great to have you on, and I want to wish you a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. We won't be talking to you until after the New Year. How are things there in Virginia? How's your self-sufficiency projects? Well, we've only got about 30 seconds, so just...
Well, they're doing okay. It's gotten very cold. I'm grateful for hydrocarbon fuels to keep us warm, though.
That's great. I won't turn you in. I won't tell anybody that you said that. We've got the Stasi Society is being set up now, but I will not inform on you. Thank you so much. Eric Peters at epautos.com, or you can also find him at Eric Peters. It's ericpetersautos.com or epautos.com.
Yep.
And either one of those. Yeah, you can get to Eric Peters. Thank you so much, Eric. Appreciate it.
Thank you, David. Merry Christmas.
I'm delighted to present something born from my love for music and the Christmas season. Christmas night is a perfect accompaniment for anything from family gatherings to moments of peaceful reflection. us to provide a fresh take to the soundtrack of Christmas. This collection of 20 instrumental songs brings new life to timeless Christmas classics. With original orchestrations alongside lesser known, yet equally enchanting carols. For the listeners of the David Knight Show, this is more than music. It's part of our shared journey. Christmas Night is available at thedavidknightshow.com. May it bring a little extra joy and peace to your Christmas season. Thank you for your unwavering support and for joining me in this new musical adventure. Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good Christmas night.